Welcome to Future Library. Again, I'm back recording and talking into your ears, listeners. A week ago, I was sitting in my room reading The Wire. When I say I was reading The Wire, I was reading an email from The Wire. And the email directed me to a page about some unreleased music by a chap called Laraji. And I thought, this looks interesting, so I clicked on it. And I listened to all the tracks on the page, and I thought, this is really good. So I then went to Spotify, and I listened to more tracks on Spotify. Then I went and read the article that was in The Wire. And then I kind of thought, you know what? I think I should speak to this guy, as he seems really interesting. So due to the wonders of the internet, less than a week after discovering him, I present you with Laraji. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Alex, and good to hear from you in this transatlantic Skype phone call.
Skype is a wonderful thing. I'm a huge fan of Skype. It allows people across the world to speak to each other for virtually no money at all. It's fantastic. You've got to love it.
Yeah, I agree.
Before I go any further, though, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's very good. And it's an interactive name, but Laraji or Laraji works wonderful.
Okay, excellent. So, well, for listeners who, like me a week ago, weren't particularly aware of who you were, tell us a bit about yourself.
Wow, a little bit.
however much you like.
Well, the body was born in Philadelphia in 1943, and two beautiful parents. My mother was a church-going seamstress, nurse, and my father was a tailor. He did some army time, and they moved up from Philadelphia to Perth Amboy, New Jersey. And that's where I went to school and was into Baptist church. And my mother was very open to me exploring music. So in the school system at Perth Amboy, New Jersey, was very open for encouraging students to explore music, a musical instrument. So I started out one in the church, singing in the choir, then school, playing violin, piano, trombone, singing in the choirs and in the bands and the orchestras and singing in the church choirs. So music was a very, very deep and strong element in my formative years. Somewhere in high school, I had gotten the notion that I wanted to be a chemical engineer or an architect. So I was preparing for a rather serious engineering career all the time with music in the background. And at one point in high school, I got the revelation that music was really my passion. So I switched my entire focus from engineering to music, and I went on to get a scholarship and go to Howard University for theory and composition and piano as a major. So I pursued my dream to be a music composer. And in college, at Howard University in Washington, D.C., I practiced piano, studied music theory and composition, pledged to fraternity, did a lot of partying, and did comedy on the side. And the comedy got to be so good that I was inspired to come to New York after 4 years of college and explore comedy as a possible way to get some income to set myself up so I could have a piano in my apartment and start composing again. But the comedy led to movies and off-Broadway and touring, and it got me into a position of really questioning my inner center before going any further into the mass media. So at that point, I began exploring meditation and world philosophies to get a stronger sense of just exactly what I wanted to do with my energies in the mass media. And exploring these spiritual disciplines opened up my creativity, my improvisational creativity, so wide that suddenly I was back into music again, and this time exploring an electronic auto harp after having a meditative experience of hearing divine sound current and being inspired to use music for consciousness purpose, for the sake of uplifting consciousness and opening consciousness. That was around the early 70s. By that time, I was married, and we gave birth to a daughter, and all of that experience helped me to sense that, gee, I wanted to do something on a global level to head off this nuclear threat to our planet. Mm-hmm. After when giving birth to a child made me aware of a sense of obligation to the next seven generations on this planet, how to keep this planet healthy and habitable for the next seven generations. So that opened up my musical direction toward using it for more humanitarian healing and mood uplifting functions on the planet. The electronic, the zither, or the auto harp, which was an exploratory instrument for me. It was lighter than a piano, and I could alter the tuning, and I could electrify it, and I could play out on the sidewalks of New York and earn money at it, and at the same time send out good vibes to sort of one man working to shift the energies on the planet. And that was in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and then into Manhattan around the early 70s, and the mid-70s to late 70s. And somewhere along the way, I met up with the Brian Eno while I was playing in Washington Square Park one evening. And he invited me to participate in an ambient music recording project he was launching at that time. An album that resulted from that meeting was called Day of Radiance Ambient Number 3. And that set me on the global theater. Mm-hmm. Music was being heard globally at that time. It took me about 5 years to really catch up to traveling to catch around the world behind that recording. But during that time, I was still exploring meditation, Tai Chi, different spiritual modalities to get clearer and deeper about my sense of purpose. And that resulted in a deeper form of music that attracted me into playing for expos, meditation centers, healing groups, and alternative music festivals and concerts. Along the way, I recorded, my early recordings were on cassette tapes. And Brian Eno's and allowed me to move into albums, vinyl, along with another album at that time called Celestial Vibration. So those were my two first albums in the late 1970s after recording mostly on cassette tapes. And into 1980s, playing for a lot of New Age conferences, expos, and meditation centers, I began recording more vinyl and eventually into CDs, compact CDs in the late 80s, expanding my audience and expanding my collaboration with other artists, not just musicians, but dancers, guided meditation people, and some film projects. And into the 90s, by that time I was working with a group that Brian had put together called Opal Evening. It was touring throughout Europe and Japan and some United States. It was composed of mostly solo performer composers who were releasing their works on Brian's label, Opal Evening, Opal Limited at that time, out of Britain. Mm-hmm. And then that project went like we traveled, and each of the artists would do their solo work during the concert, and we'd all come together at the end and do collaboration, spontaneous collaboration. And out of those spontaneous collaborations came some music that was further released in separate albums. One of them was Flow Goes the Universe. Along the way, Opal kind of softened, and All Saint Records took over. And for the last 5 or 6 years, All Saints has been kind of quiet, so I haven't released any major releases until just this October, when All Saints, in collaboration with Warp Records out of England, decided to release three albums, one a retrospective and two other are re-releases. And this is parallel, an album release that came out of California by a record company called Light in the Attic, which released an anthology of New Age musicians from the 70s and 80s, on which I am included. So that's four albums that came out simultaneously in October. And here I am, when it rains, it pours, talking to Alex.
it seems from what I'm reading that there's been this, as you say, this sudden kind of explosion in interest again. Like, it's like a new generation has come to your work and has become aware of it. I mean, I understand there's a remix record coming as well. Is that correct?
When you say the remix, which one are the two? There are two out that are a remix.
All right, because yes. The one I'm thinking of is the one that it was listed on the little kind of page on the Wire that had people like Motion Sickness of Time Travel and Bee Mask on it, talking about the things like A Cave in England and Space Choir being remixed.
Yes, that one is Flow Goes the Universe, that's a remix, and Audio Active, The Way In is the Way Out. Those two albums are included in a double album.
Ah.
And they're called Two Sides of Laraji is the name of that album.
Fantastic.
And it includes those remixes.
Well, I think it's interesting that these guys are remixing your work, because when I first started listening to it a week ago, it struck me as how kind of current it sounds, and I've not found anything that I've listened to from you that sounds remotely dated. I think the music you're doing, or have been doing for all these years, seems to me to have this kind of timeless quality that has kind of...
Yes.
It seems to me that a lot of things that are going on in the US underground at the moment are starting to kind of align with what you've been doing for a long time. So there's a lot of young guys out there, and young men and women, making music that's kind of similar to the way you've worked for a long time with your kind of setup with the zithers and the synths and all the various things you've got in there. So, I mean, did you find that your music just came to you as it was, or did you work at it, or was it just a kind of fully formed thing that popped into your head?
Well, Alex, what started it, I guess, was having a full-blown divine hearing experience in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
which I could say it sounded like a cosmic orchestra of brass instruments weaving this timeless cacophony that had no ending or beginning, and it seemed to be the soundtrack of the infinite universe having its cosmic reunion. And during that experience, I had an emotional experience. I could say, closest I could say, is that my heart cracked open, falling in love with the universe on a deeper level. And what came out of that was a desire to emulate that experience, or to share it, or to do something with it. I couldn't record it, and I can't actually play that music, but it inspired the music I do, and it drives the music that I do now. And I guess what I got out of that experience is a sense of timeless quality that you mentioned, that somehow I've been able to let it flow through the music that I do. Along the way, I've experimented with different effects for the zither, different tunings, different ways of playing the zither on a harp. And so the vocabulary for the instrument just slowly evolved through trial and error, hit or miss, sort of like cooking with ingredients you weren't familiar with,
mm-hmm.
till you taste them. And what evolved is a vocabulary of using electronic treatments and different techniques of getting sounds from the instruments, along with other things like voices and kalimbas and synthesizers. So it grew step by step. The only a sound that I heard that inspired me in this direction was that inner sound experience, which drove me emotionally
mm-hmm.
to seek out a compliment on this side of the veil, as it were.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting. I think, so it seems that, how can I word it? It seems that there's this, like I say, the timelessness of it really kind of speaks to me. I'm kind of feeling a little bit bad because my zither's sitting upstairs.
You have a zither too.
I do, and it has a pickup stuck to the underside of it as well.
We have to get together, Alex.
Well, next time you're in the UK, for sure, definitely. You see, I've got a zither with a little contact mic stuck to, like gaffer taped to the underneath, and I've got a thumb piano with the same thing.
Wow!
You know, so I've kind of. I think that's the other thing that kind of reached out to me from your music was that a lot of the things that you use are things that I've been playing around with for the last few years and using as sources for kind of what I tend to do is I play little bits and then sample them into my laptop and then do things with them afterwards. Excuse me. And I think that kind of reached out to me as well. And I think what really kind of blew me away was some of the kind of quite early things, like things from the, well, you know, things that from my point of view would be early, like 1987 and stuff, seemed very, very much like, almost sounded like modern electronica. And,
mm-hmm.
and it seems that there's kind of creating this sound that sounds almost like it's been put together on a computer, but which has clearly not been. It's been clearly done, you know, manually and, you know, with a great deal of love and time put into it. And I think that's a fantastic thing. I think that's also partly what's maybe talking to this new generation of people who are starting to discover your music. I think it was interesting what you said about having a child kind of focusing the mind about the future. I found exactly the same when I had my two sons. It does have the effect of stopping you just thinking about your immediate lifespan, doesn't it?
Yes.
You could go, well, you know, I'm going to be gone one day, but my child isn't. And then when grandchildren come along, you're like, oh, they're still going to be around. And then, you know, and I find it's really kind of tied me into a feeling of continuation into the future. But
yes.
But it's also made me appreciate the past that I've come from, you know, and that it's this unbroken kind of chain of existence of individuals, but the same kind of genetic information going forward and backwards in a huge direction. But I don't know where I'm going with that.
What you just said allowed me to connect a little deeper to your title of Future Library.
Well, that's it. Yeah, the title of it is that the idea of the podcast was that I want it to be something that people can look back on at some mm-hmm. point, because I think part of, from my point of view, part of becoming kind of aware of mortality is feeling that I want to leave behind a body of work. And,
yeah.
you know, I've got a lot of music out there, but I kind of feel that there's, if people want to know a bit about me, they need to hear me talking. And so, yeah. So anyway, that's why I called it Future Library, because I see it as at some point it's going to be finished and it'll be something I'll look back on and go, oh, you know, I did some good work there. Or,
yes. You know. I have sort of similar feeling that I think of the work as I'm doing will be music that I'll enjoy listening to in my very senior years.
Absolutely.
Serene, relaxed, easy on the breath, and allowing me to just be in contemplation or be in my gentle years gently.
Well, that's another thing I noticed about your music was that you seem to have this talent for making music that can be as... you can involve yourself as much as you like in it, or you can really step back from it. So I can sit and listen to it and find myself very kind of engrossed in the textures and what's going on and be very conscious of it. Or I can put it on quite quietly and listen to it while I'm falling asleep. And it seems to serve both purposes. and I think it was quite interesting what you were saying about doing the performances for kind of alternative shows in the States, but also doing shows at kind of expos and yoga classes and things. I think that's a kind of a unique situation that you're in, that you've got your foot in kind of these two completely different worlds.
Yeah.
And
they help to feed both worlds too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I do concerts, let's say electronic or alternative music concerts, traveling with other artists. I become familiar with a technology that I can explore and experiment with, and I can take that back to my meditation yoga classes to play for and give them a unique sound. And then out of my meditation yoga new age conferences, I I get deeper into understanding and consciousness, which I can take and put into my more electronic mainstream concert performances. So I can bring a meditative, gentle, healing quality to my more world concert kind of audiences. Mm-hmm. And I can bring more of a world technology, explored technology, to meditative yoga, New Age conference kind of setting.
See, that's fantastic.
A unique, what do they call it, symbiotic or exchange.
Yeah. Well, I just realized that describing you as having one foot in each of them seems to be slightly inappropriate. I think it's actually fairer to say you've got both feet in both.
Wow,
I think
thank
simultaneously
you.
You've managed to kind of overlap these two things completely, and you kind of stand comfortably in both of them. Because I think the phrase, you know, having one foot in two, you know, one foot in one camp, one foot in the other, has a slightly kind of negative connotation. And I don't want this to have that, because I don't think there's that going on. I think you've obviously got a mastery of both sides of it and a complete understanding of both sides of it. And as you say, you're pulling elements from one into the other and allowing them to kind of cross-pollinate.
Yes, that is well said.
And I think that's a really good thing, because you're exposing people who are going to the retreats and the classes and things. You're exposing them to maybe music that they wouldn't hear otherwise.
Yes.
And you're pulling in elements that you're kind of learning from the kind of more, as you put it, the more kind of mainstream concert side of things. And then at the other side, you're pulling your experiences from the meditative side into the concerts. And I think it benefits both sides, and I think that's a really positive thing to do. So I think thumbs up on that one, definitely. I understand as well you do laughter courses.
Yes, lots, more and more. It's like a double career, or they both complement each other. This, laughter has been a strong element in my expression ever since grade school. I'm finding one way or another to get people into the laughter zone. It was a way of self-preservation, as I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood. And throughout high school and college, I got involved with comedy programs, writing comedy, being in comedy teams. Coming to New York in the late 60s, I explored comedy as a way of making money, and stand-up comedy, doing off-Broadway and some film work. One of the films was called Putney Swope. I did some television commercials. And I got into the consciousness side of things. And what I gathered from the consciousness side of things is that the comedy I was doing was polarizing. It was getting people to laugh by polarizing people. And I rethought, did I really want to continue doing that? And so I softened my approach to comedy for a while, but that time music took off and started becoming the main center of my life. And somewhere around when I got into the conference circuit in the early 80s with my music, someone made me aware of laughter as being a form of meditation, and I explored it. It was a suggestion of Rajneesh, Bhagwan Rajneesh, who's now called Osho, who promoted laughter as a form of meditation. And when I was exposed to that attitude, it opened up my attitude of using laughter as a form of meditation, and then developing a workshop around it. And so that pulled me back into working with laughter, but with different hours and different groups and a different format. Now I'm working with laughter as a way of getting into meditation and a way of opening up ourselves to the health benefits of conscious laughter.
Mm-hmm.
It's less about telling jokes. It's less about laughing at something, and it's more about using our ability to instigate laughter and direct the force, the physical vibration of our laughter into different energy centers in our body. But along the journey of these play shops, warm human interaction occurs, and warm, spontaneous laughter erupts alongside of the stage intentional laughter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's one of the things, isn't it, that with laughter, that you can start it off with, as you say, the kind of the forced laughter, and then it does start to generate. People hear other people laughing, and it sort of sets them off. And I think. I think, which is probably the reason why they always used to have the kind of laughter tracks on sitcoms back in the day. You know, it's kind of a cue in one way to say you are allowed to laugh at this part. But I think it's also to kind of get the subconscious into a place where it can accept that laughing is okay.
Yes, those laughters, as I remember, Alex, were polite laughter.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't the kind of laughter that my friends we would crack up.
Yeah.
And I never heard any of those canned laughter really include the cracking up kind of laughter, mm-hmm. but they were polite laughter.
Well, I think the kind of, to my mind, the laughter that I enjoy the most is where I'm laughing so hard that I've got tears rolling down my face. I think that's, you know, when you're kind of gasping for breath and you're laughing so hard and you can feel you're laughing with your whole body. That's the kind of laughter that I enjoy the most, I think.
That is, I'm kind of uplifted to hear you say that, because there's been a slight image of that British people don't get into laughter that deeply.
You see me?
And at least I don't see it. and I don't see it on a large scale, that there's a reservedness. Laughter is more of a reserved experience, but I'm willing to unlearn that attitude.
Well, I think it's something that I think there's a part of it that we kind of present to the rest of the world, is this attitude that the nation is very kind of, you know, reserved and controlled. I mean, my wife's American, and she's been surprised at how all the things she thought about the UK and about the British have turned out to slowly not be true. But they kind of were only true to her in the first place because the British had allowed that image to kind of persist, if you see what I mean. Obviously I can only speak from my own kind of subjective experience of it, but I think the British comedy is certainly very, it allows itself to laugh at itself. Obviously kind of sarcasm, something that we're very big on in the UK. I think there's a certain sort of self-awareness when we're laughing, and certainly when I've been to see stand-up comedians, audiences are more than happy to really kind of let go and laugh very, very hard.
Let go and laugh.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. I think the more people laugh, because I kind of wonder if it's almost has the same effect on human beings as purring does on cats.
Hmm.
You know?
The soothing.
Yeah.
Releasing. Cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
Transforming stuck, blocked, rigid places into fluid, open, soft, reduces armor, mm-hmm. rigidity, and it takes us into our vulnerability, that emotional openness.
Yeah, because you're absolutely right, because I mean, it is a very kind of emotional display, almost. It's an outward display of emotion, and I think certainly in the world that we live in today, that kind of thing is maybe frowned upon a little bit, that, you know, especially in the current kind of global climate, that things are seen as being very serious and difficult. And I think it always makes me happy when I see pictures of people smiling or laughing, even in difficult situations, because I think
that
gives me a feeling of hope about the future of our species. You know, I think it's that attitude that's going to allow us to kind of keep going and to get beyond where we are now. And it's going to be that kind of attitude that's going to get us that properly out into space.
And, I do agree.
You know, and I think that's important. I think it's really important that we try and push forward as much as we can, because
yes, that in pushing forward, I think of laughter or laughter work, even comedy. Is energy work. It's mm-hmm. moving energy. It's suggesting the movement of energy in spite of what the outer picture, the outer environment is suggesting for us. Mm-hmm. Whether the outer suggestion is to be in fear or to be in doubt or to be in paranoia, that laughter, even smiling, can suggest an openness and a flowing and a movement of energy.
Mm-hmm. It encourages people to share experience and to empathize with each other. And I think that's hugely valuable. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with music as well. That's got the same kind of... So I can see where you're coming from with the two things kind of complementing each other. It seems to me that both strands of what you're doing there are about bringing people together in a kind of in an environment where they can allow themselves to express kind of maybe a vulnerability to themselves, or allow themselves to be vulnerable in a situation where that vulnerability won't then be taken advantage of.
Yes. I do state at the beginning of the workshops that the shortest distance between two people is laughter. And I make sure that before we get into the heart of this play shop, that we are all connecting to the inner child by mm-hmm. getting into the play zone. And that playfulness and having the inner child out makes us less rigid about connecting with one another and sharing openly and entering a community, a spontaneous community of warmth and trust.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the way forward for us as a species. I think we've got to re-embrace that sense of community and to allow ourselves to accept kind of local communities and the benefits that those local communities have on a global scale if everybody's in local communities.
Mm.
You know, does that make sense? Does that sound...
Yes.
Yeah.
And at the same time, to say that there is something called reservations or inappropriate laughter. Mm-hmm. For instance, would you expect the Prime Minister to make a speech on television but open up with cracking up for 1 minute? No. And also, I understand that in the school systems here, when a teacher is not going to be in and a substitute teacher must take their place for a few days, I understand that the substitute teacher is advised not to laugh with the students, but to establish a sense of authority for mm-hmm. the first day or so. That laughter can challenge a sense of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a thing where it would be great to think of everyone laughing and smiling all the time. But in cases where you need to think of authority or a hierarchy, for instance, I know that employers will laugh among themselves in a way that they won't laugh amongst their employees.
Mm-hmm.
Employees will laugh amongst themselves in a way that they won't laugh in front of their employer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it would be slightly inappropriate if, say, you know, President Obama appeared on television to announce some catastrophe and opened it by having a bit of a chuckle at the start. I think it would send the wrong message.
It would. It would send the wrong message outwardly, but it could send a good message inwardly.
Yes.
But then if you're a president, it means you've got your wits about you.
Yeah. Well, one would hope. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, our politicians in the UK have to get quite used to being laughed at and being challenged kind of publicly. Certainly the way a lot of our television interviewers deal with them, they show a lot less respect than I think American politicians get. That's one of the things that really surprised my wife when she came here. Was
in Great Britain, you think you get less respect than in US?
I think politicians do. I think they still get a certain amount of respect, but I think they're treated as being just other human beings who are doing a job that have been voted in by the people, and
okay.
they are answerable to us.
You
know, and I think that's a healthy thing as well.
Yes.
You know, I think that kind of sense of... I think it's one of the things I like about the British is there's that sense of... respect is earned rather than automatically bestowed just because of a title.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see, like, the Prime Minister will be on something like the TV show Newsnight with the interviewer Jeremy Paxman. And Paxman will just really go at him, and he won't give him an inch. And he won't kind of be like, oh, well, thank you for coming on. He'll be like, you know, well, you've lied to the House, haven't you? You've done this, you've done that. What do you have to say to it, Prime Minister? And I think that can be quite healthy as well. So I think the kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to work out how a kind of combination of various things would work. How do we make this kind of perfect society where you have the openness that laughter can bring, the appropriate time for laughter? I don't know, it's a bigger problem than I can figure out in a podcast.
Well, as you go into that area of the ideal, mm-hmm. perfect society, where laughter is more available and more pronounced. Well, if you look at children, if we had a society of just children, well, our children would freak out if there was no one there to take care of them. But let's say the children were laughing and playing all the time and didn't have that perspective of 6 months ahead or 7 months mm-hmm. ahead, that they were more in present time, and they had a sense that their major responsibilities were being taken care of by someone else. They were free and able to be in lightness and in spontaneity, mm-hmm. and the spontaneous. They were free to spontaneously explore sensations that came up, that as opposed to being fearful or being in doubt or being in paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of a perfect society or a perfect world where that kind of lightness would prevail, it as I'm talking, I think a far-out image would be, let's say, meta-terrestrials coming in and taking over the planet and being our stewards and our guardians, and suddenly we're released from all responsibilities and we can be in the play zone.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to think of what kind of situation would a planet of adults be, that they were freed up to not have to be concerned about the next 10 days and next 3 years or a 5-year plan, and that the major responsibilities were taken care of, and they were free to play and explore all sensations. Probably a planet of artists could be like that.
Well, it's interesting that you're saying that, because I don't know if you've ever been aware of the Scottish author Ian M. Banks.
No.
But he wrote unfortunately, he died this year quite young. He was in his 50s, and he developed cancer and died, which is a great loss because he was a fantastic writer. But in his science fiction books, he's written a society that's very much like that. The overall day-to-day running of the society is run by sentient computers, which are entirely benevolent, and the entire society is just given over all of that side to just letting these super powerful artificial intelligences run everything. They're post-scarcity, so nobody's wanting for anything. So it's a very, very socialist environment because of that. And the only kind of real rule they have is that, well, they don't appear to have any law. It seems to be an anarchist post-scarcity society where your reputation is important. And if you do something bad, you'll lose, you know, reputation, and people won't want to be around you. And because everybody wants to be liked by everybody else, everybody just behaves really nicely. And it has generated this whole kind of society of artists and people who kind of want to go and try things out. They're very interesting books. It's a series called The Culture Novels.
The Culture Novels?
Yeah, by Ian M. Banks. And I'll email you a link afterwards. I'll email you some details of them.
I appreciate that. Yes.
Yeah, because they are really good novels. And, you know, he writes these, a lot of his stories are about how, about the kind of conflict that arises when this almost utopian society, which has got almost godlike powers because of this, you know, it has these supermassive starships that are entirely sentient and all this kind of stuff, and are treated as members of the society. It's all about how other societies rub up against them when they come mm-hmm. in contact with them. But the whole notion that if something is sentient in that society, it is treated as an equal member of that society, whether it's a small computer sitting on your desk or a starship that's 200 kilometers long. All these things are treated as individuals within the society with equal rights. And I think that, to my mind, is that to me would be the perfect society, because you could do what you want without harming anybody, and you could trust that nobody wanted to harm you, And as you say, you'd have that upper level of things looking after the day-to-day running of it. But I wonder how people would deal with that. You know, would we all... Would there be a bit of a time of readjustment if we faced that?
Yes, especially if you grew up under a certain family discipline and you want to emulate it. You want to have children, you want to have a job, you want to have a car, you want to have a house, and you want to have your 2.5 point children. Mm-hmm. So if you want to give up the old vision of struggling and be in bliss,
yeah.
In the spiritual side of things, if I can call it a side, mm-hmm. but a spiritual understanding that permeates, I guess, all of the disciplines I've explored, is that our basic core nature is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
This bliss is independent of happiness or sadness. It's a state of continuous, omnipresent equilibrium. And it's something you don't associate with human existence. But the spiritual teachings is that the human body comes and goes, but underlying it and permeating it is the true self, which in itself is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
And is when this blissful self identifies with the body, then it tries to live the agenda of the body, and that's when it runs into resistance, and it runs into the experience of relativity and losing things, and things die and things come to you. And this fluctuation and this to and fro, this relativity, is what gets in the way of a sustained experiencing the underlying blissful nature.
Mm-hmm.
See, why did I go there? It's that when you think of, if we were just to think of ourselves as individual human beings in a society, each one reaching for their level of happiness and sustaining it, that happiness could come and could go. But if each individual were to dive beneath the surface of the appearance of being separate individuals, mm-hmm. and reconnect with the underlying current that, whether we call it the I Am, whether we call it the God Presence, or we call it Allah, or call it the Great Spirit, call it that underlying common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could feel it, feel its eternity, feel its universal presence, I believe each individual could import a sense of bliss that could translate into a rather unique form of happiness, well-being, and equilibrium into life. In the case of performing artists, you would find it the artist importing inspirations for rather sublime and euphoric kinds of designs and creative expressions.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think I had a thought about that as we were talking. I think to me, one of the things that's really kind of changed my perspective about the world is that reading up about things like evolutionary biology and realizing that all humans are almost identical genetically. You know, we're so close to each other. You know, if you were to take us, you know, it's
we both have two nostrils.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But if you take it right down to the level of just the DNA, my DNA and your DNA is practically identical, and it's the same for everybody, which means that our subjective experience of reality is pretty much the same for everybody. And I think that's an important thing that people miss. I think we all kind of feel that we're kind of locked in our heads, and the universe is made up of two parts, the part that's inside us and everything else. And I think if we kind of realize that we're all broadly the same, I think that would be a positive thing for people. And I think it's a difficult thing for people to take on, but I think it's a useful thing to realize. And I think it kind of fits a little bit with what you were saying about the underlying spirit and things. And from my take on it, is that is what I would define as the underlying spirit, the kind of realization of similarity and kinship.
Yes, getting in touch with that.
Mm, yeah, because I think you know, if you realize that everybody else is the same as you, and has the same fears and the same, you know, the same autonomic responses to things. You know, their body's going to respond in the same way. I think people would be less likely to kill each other or steal
from
each other.
They would, and they would probably be in a better position to love and share meaningful expression experiences with one another.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a positive thing. And I think on a positive note, that's a good place to draw things to a close. But before we do, tell me, where would people go to find out more information about your work?
Okay. One would be go to my... you could go to a video that's on the air. Maybe you saw it already.
Is that the one on...
Vimeo?
Yeah, on Vimeo, yes.
Oh, you saw that one.
Yeah, I posted a link to that. So online, so because you've got a website as well, haven't you?
Yes, I do. And that is http /laraji.blogspot.
Fantastic. And I will put a link to this in the... the details of the podcast when it comes out.
Blogspot.com.
Yeah. And I'll put a link to the video as well, because there's the little video of kind of introduction to you, isn't it? A little 12-minute film, which I was watching earlier. There's also a very good article in The Wire this month, and I'm getting the feeling that there's going to be a lot of people talking about you in the near future as this sudden explosion of fresh interest takes hold.
Yes. I did go on your website, and I saw quite a few videos there.
Yeah.
And some are an hour long, and you've been doing quite a bit of work.
Oh, I do a lot. I do more than one podcast. You see, I do another one that's about... it started out as a kind of atheism podcast, and it's kind of developed into other things. But the future library stuff, yeah, I've done quite a lot over the last couple of years now, and it's starting to really pick up. So
congratulations.
I try. So thank you. But it's an absolute pleasure being able to speak to people like yourself. You know, I think
thank you, Alex.
You know, it's great. And I'm really hoping that a new generation will come to your music and will go, this is amazing stuff.
Okay. By the way, how close do you live to London?
About 100 miles.
Okay. All right, I keep that in mind. I'm due to do some concerts there in the next year.
All right, okay. Well, my wife and I will try and get down to see you then, because it's not too hard, too difficult for us to travel down there. So,
okay.
Yeah. So that answers the question I was going to ask: is, you know, when are you coming to play in the UK?
And
you
just something being the planned now. I'm out of Warp. Warp Records is planning.
Fantastic.
I don't know where it'll be, but.
Well, if you get a chance to play anywhere else, I live in Birmingham, so just up the road. So, yeah, do a little tour. Come and play the whole of the UK. People will come in here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you ever so much for talking to me. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. I recommend all the listeners go out and listen to stuff. I will put information in the webpage that this is on. And it's been a pleasure speaking to you, so thank you very much.
Beautiful evening to you.
Okay, thank you. Cheers. Bye-bye. Future Library is brought to you by petpiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/futurelibrary1, so that's Future Library with a number 1. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.